These are folks that in some cases had a very successful path through life that it was diverted to a very unsuccessful path.
A legislative effort to combat opioid abuse. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a California man is snatching up dozens of pieces of property in Saldovia and angering his neighbors.
To make it into a soundbite, you know, he came and tried to buy a town and it doesn't want to be bought.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The Senate Finance Committee has been weighing a wide-ranging bill to overhaul Medicaid in Alaska. One provision is aimed at curbing the abuse of opioid drugs. Senate Bill 74 would require doctors to check a database before prescribing opioids. The sponsors want to make sure patients aren't going from doctor to doctor seeking pills. Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki says he became interested in the prescription database when many of his constituents were victims of burglaries. The culprits had addictions. He attended court-ordered group therapy sessions so he could better understand the issue.
These are folks that in some cases had a very successful path through life, like mine or any other Alaskan, that it was diverted to a very unsuccessful path.
Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon supports making doctors check the database.
Someone is providing access to a variety of opioids on our streets, and then when they can't get the prescription any longer, they're turning to heroin, and young men, older women, female, male, are losing their lives.
But the proposal has drawn concern from doctors' groups. While the Alaska State Medical Association supports doctors using the database, it doesn't support requiring it for every controlled drug. Association leaders say removing doctors' discretion would create an unnecessary burden and increase costs. Emergency room doctors have voiced concerns. Dr. Carlton Hine says he agrees with 90% of what the legislators want to do, but he says doctors aren't solely to blame. He notes that beginning in the 1990s, organizations that accredit hospitals and federal programs that pay doctors encourage doctors to prescribe more pain meds.
It's not just that we, you know, are trying to do it to create addicts. There are other situations out there that are pressuring the behavior that you're seeing. I do think we need to find some way to identify the providers that are overprescribing. I think that is a problem, and I get frustrated with that personally when I see patients coming in knowing who their provider might be.
The committee made changes to address some of the doctors' concerns. It provided exemptions from checking the database to doctors whose patients are in emergencies and inpatient settings and on the day of surgeries. The Senate Finance Committee could vote on the bill as soon as Monday. Hawk Inlet is healthy, according to state officials. That's the message Ann Goon received about 3 weeks after the mayor raised concerns about high levels of mercury found in a subsistence seal. But as KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins explains, Ann Goon's mayor doesn't feel comforted by the report.
In the 20-page document, the state agencies say they appreciate the citizen science used to determine the seal had high levels of mercury. The letter cautions children, the elderly, and pregnant women against eating certain parts of an older seal, like the liver. For everyone else, the department recommends limiting consumption. Other traditional foods, it says, are safe to eat. But Angoon's mayor, Albert Howard, says he doesn't feel heard by the agencies, and the information isn't practical.
When you spend $40-something dollars for gas in Angoon to go hunting, you're going to make the most of it. If you see one seal and it just happens to be the older one, that's a risk people are taking, and nobody's going to eat 4 ounces of seal meat.
Ali Hamade, an environmental public health program manager with the health department, says older seals store up more mercury in their organs. They can swim far distances.
Chances are that seal picked up some of the mercury from Hawk Inlet and from outside Hawk Inlet, depending where that seal spent its life. And with mercury in particular, it builds up with age. It bioaccumulates.
The place where the seal was harvested is also home to Hecla's Greens Creek Mine, which, according to the letter, is meeting its permitted conditions. But it doesn't discount the origin of the metals could have come from there. Historical mining could be a factor. So could natural occurrences like drainages and streams. KJ Metcalf says he found some parts of the letter puzzling. He's part of the environmental advocacy group that took the tissue sample of the seal. And he says some of his concerns weren't addressed. His group and Ngoon questioned why a 1981 baseline study before the mine was up and running isn't being reproduced to test the quality of the water.
I'm really curious as to why there's such reluctance to use it, because I think it's the gold standard that is going to give a definitive determination as to the health of the inlet.
Metcalf says the study, which was lost and rediscovered in an old Forest Service file, offers a better glimpse of the pre-mining conditions. But the state's rep for the Department of Environmental Conservation says the testing that's done now is more streamlined, less broad. The 1981 version would require more resources, and the state could have difficulty imposing and monitoring it under the mine's current permit. It wasn't brought up in the letter because it's been discussed before. Still, when it comes to where the mercury is coming from, no one can say for sure. Albert Howard says that's not comforting.
I want the state to come in and deal with this in a timely manner so we can move on and make sure the health and well-being of our food supply is good. It's that simple, so our people can take care of themselves like they've always done.
The Alaska Environmental Public Health Program has offered hair sample tests to Ngoon's residents to determine their levels of mercury. The state is considering the possibility of testing more seals. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Hundreds of youth and adults are in Fairbanks as part of 4-H Western Region Leaders Forum. KUAC's Robert Hannon reports.
For some 40 years, 4-H clubs in the 13 western states have taken turns hosting the regional forum. Jan Hanscom is past president of the state volunteer organization. She says the current event has drawn some 300 4-H leaders and agents to Fairbanks, where they'll take in at least 100 workshops on everything from swine matchmaking to constructing a rocket stove or cuspuck. Hanscom says interest in 4-H today is growing as more people wonder how and where their food is grown.
Why are we shipping food from millions of miles away to get it to Fairbanks? And oh, by the way, the barge broke down, so now we don't have food in the store.
Hanscom says 4-H teaches kids about more than farming. It also focuses on science and the skills it takes to succeed today. 55 teens and their chaperones spent the day at UAF touring the campus. She says the visit underscores the vital connection 4-H has with the university's co-op extension service, a connection that's at risk in the legislature's current budget.
If the university and the state does not provide the matching funds, cooperative extension will go away this year, and that would mean no more 4-H.
Hanscom says it's hard to forecast the 4-H's future in the state, but more immediately, the Regional Leaders Forum continues at the Westmark Hotel through Friday. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Coast Guard rescues two British explorers attempting to cross the part of the Bering Strait.
So there was really no way out of it. We were caught in this ice drifting north, further and further away from our objective.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Two British explorers were rescued from the Bering Strait yesterday. The men were attempting to cross the strait when they began to drift north into the open ocean. KNOM's Emily Russell reports.
British explorers Neil Lawton and James Bingham started their journey on foot from the village of Wales Wednesday morning. They plan to walk over ice and paddle in open water in the hopes of reaching the island of Little Diomede. Bingham says they fell victim to changing ice conditions in the Bering Strait.
The issue we face now with global warming is that the ice just isn't forming. So it makes what was already a challenging expedition close to impossible.
They knew they needed to be prepared for open water since Bingham made a similar attempt just last year. He was deterred by the inconsistent sea ice conditions. This and last year's attempts are practice. The two are training to cross the entire Bering Strait in 2017. Neil Lawton says things started to go wrong by the end of their first day.
We'd been paddling quite hard for 9 or 10 hours. Got approximately halfway across the strait.
That's when he says they noticed ice forming around their kayaks.
We were having to punch through with the paddles to break the ice to make progress. And it was very hard, very slow, and quite debilitating.
Near nightfall, they couldn't continue paddling because of the thin ice. And they couldn't pitch a tent due to the lack of thick ice. Instead, they pulled their kayaks up onto the slushy ice and hunkered down.
We spent the night in the open with our clothing, kind of involuntary shivering for the next 12 hours until daybreak.
By the time the two woke up, the ice had frozen around them. Bingham says it started to carry them even farther north into open ocean.
So there was really no way out of it. We were caught in this ice drifting north, further and further away from our objective.
It was at that point that Bingham and Lawton decided to call for help. They both say they would have kept going if the ice were thicker. Lawton says that it still wasn't solid enough to walk across.
As soon as you stepped off onto this ice, there were parts where it would hold you for a bit, and then suddenly your feet would go through and you'd fall in. So it was just a pretty dire situation. You couldn't paddle, you couldn't walk. Check, checkmate.
We were in Kodiak getting ready for a training flight, and the SAR alarm went off.
That's U.S. Coast Guard Lieutenant Andrew Jerelimic. Air Station Kodiak was contacted for the search and rescue mission Thursday morning. They sent a C-130 aircraft and two Jayhawk helicopters. Lawton and Bingham were spotted from the C-130 drifting on a section of sea ice about 25 nautical miles northwest of Wales. Jerelimic, who was piloting one of the Jayhawks, lowered a rescue swimmer down onto the ice.
He was able to kind of give them a general assessment, and they were cold, but in good spirits and happy to be rescued.
Jerelimic says they were actually well prepared for the expedition, but the drifting sea ice worked against the two explorers. Lawton and Bingham were flown back to Nome yesterday afternoon. Lawton says they escaped mostly unscathed.
James has a little frostbite on his fingers. Me being a bit older and uglier and harder skin, I'm fine, thanks.
Lawton, who has summited Mount Everest 5 times and skied to both the North and South Poles, says the Bering Strait crossing is at the top of his list. But ice conditions in the strait are now so unpredictable that a crossing of this kind may be nearing impossible in the years to come. With reporting help from KNOM's Mitch Borden, I'm Emily Russell in Nome.
The 44th annual Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race gets underway on Sunday, although the festive ceremonial start in Anchorage happens tomorrow. This is one of the largest fields in the race's history at 85 mushers signed up to start. KNOM News Director Emily Schwing and Alaska Public Media Zachariah Hughes will be reporting from the trail. Before they take off, let's find out who they're keeping an eye on and what to watch out for along the trail. Hello.
Hi, Lori.
Hello.
Thanks for being here, both of you. Emily, you've been covering sled dog races for 6 years. Who are the teams to watch this year in the Iditarod?
Well, Dallas CV, returning champion. He's definitely a team to keep an eye on. He's won 3 times in the last 4 years and placed in the top 2 on all 4 years. So he told me he's got a bunch of 3-year-olds that were trained up on a puppy team last year by Christian Turner. And he also is still running a bunch of his veteran dogs, and his leaders are veterans returning to the trail. And then there's Brent Sass. In the last 2 years, you know, he hasn't made it to Nome for a couple different reasons. He had kind of misinterpreted the race rules and had a iPod that was not allowed on the trail, so he was disqualified in Tanana. So he's pretty hungry to get to Nome this year. There's also a handful of folks that we definitely probably wouldn't expect to see up front, but I think they definitely have an opportunity, especially they know how to race this race. And that's Jor Olsson, Sigurd Ekron, and Nicholas Petit. They're younger mushers. They're very experienced on this trail and others, both in Alaska. And Sigurd Ekron and Jor are Norwegian. They're very competitive mushers who've done well in Norway as well.
All right. Thanks for that. Zach, what do we know about trail conditions? Anchorage had to borrow snow from Fairbanks.
Give it back in a little while.
What's it going to look like out there?
From Willow onward, there's actually really good snow. Some of it hard and fast, some of it a little bit icy and more precarious. And I've definitely heard some mixed things about areas, but I think the big takeaway is, after 2014, with the really just radically unsafe conditions coming out of the Dalzell Gorge and across the burn, and mushers being not only upset, but physically injured and battered and broken after that, there was this kind of never again mantra. And the race officials know that. They felt the pressure, and it sounds like they made sure to double check that this was a trail that could be runnable safely. So there's not a lot of sea ice along the coast at this point. It's been a really bad year for sea ice. And that's definitely going to change some of the routing. We know that there's already the plan to dip inland, coming north up the coast from Unalakleet to Shaktoolik to Koyuk. And the race officials say they haven't routed Golovin Bay yet on the way into Nome. But that's a lot of what we're working with.
Covering the race is a lot of work, but it's also a lot of fun. Emily, what are you most looking forward to?
I'm most looking forward to the unexpected, incredible performances. Last year, we saw a bunch of really young mushers pull off some incredible finishes, most notably Travis Beals and Wade Mars. Wade Mars posted the fastest finish time from safety to Nome and finished in 10th place. Travis Beals finished in 11th. These are two really young guys that no one sort of expected to see in Nome that seemingly early. There's a handful of other dark horses that I can't wait to find out who they are and if I've chosen the right ones and what they're going to do out there.
All right. How about you, Zach?
I'm just really excited to be there. I've never been on the trail before. I think of this as some of the most exciting material and stories and just mythology that still exists robustly in the state. And the chance to get to go to such diverse parts of the state, whether it's the mountains or the coast or the interior and the Yukon, to get to see unity and just connection across the state from Anchorage all the way to Nome, where I used to live. There's nothing else like it in Alaska.
Thanks to both of you. Be careful out there. Have a great time. We look forward to the stories.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Full Circle, delivering organic produce and groceries across Alaska since 2006, featuring fresh pasta, coffee, fish, and baked items from Alaskan producers. More at fullcircle.com/APRN. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Elder Mentor Program is seeking low-income seniors age 55 or older who have a passion for children and for sharing cultural values. Eligibility information at ruralcap.com. This message sponsored by Rural Alaska Community Action Program, Inc.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Philip Manning. This week on AK, Outsider. Over the last 8 years, a California man has snatched up dozens of parcels of land in the small community of Seldovia on Kachemak Bay. His work on that property has dragged him into legal disputes with the city of Seldovia and some of his neighbors. KBBI's Quentin Chandler reports anxiety in the community is boiling over, and most people just want the conflict to end.
During Greg Davis's first years in Seldovia, residents were concerned about the amount of property he was buying, but they weren't overly alarmed. Brettwood Hickman says he met Davis about 5 years ago. He didn't see him much after that, but Davis and Hickman's father became good friends. Then, in the summer of 2015, Davis's tone in town started to change.
He seemed to have this vision, and he talked about this vision of improving Seldovia and coming in from the outside, buying, he talks about buying properties because they were ugly and improving them, cleaning them up.
Davis owns 42 properties inside and outside of Seldovia city limits through his family business, Precious Earth. Seldovians say that's a lot of land for one man, especially in a town that recorded a population of only 233 people in 2014.
To make it into a soundbite, you know, he came and tried to buy a town and it doesn't want to be bought.
Hickman's family owns beach property surrounded by Davis's land. They can access it by water and by walking the beach during low tide. But for about 35 years, Hickman says the family has mainly used a trail that crosses Davis's land. Hickman says Davis recently told his family he didn't want them to use the trail anymore. Last year, Davis put up a no trespassing sign. Hickman's mother crossed Davis's property at least twice after that, but the police declined to intervene. Hickman says from there, things escalated.
He sent this email where he lays out very clearly this threat of physical violence, that he would take the law into his own hands, and he's threatening that against my family. And I don't, I can't see past that. Like, at this point, there's no hope of actually communicating with him like another human being, which is what I'd rather be doing.
Most other residents in town agree. Jeremiah Campbell bought the Boardwalk Hotel in Seldovia about 3 years ago. He says Davis made a lot of other residents mad when he burned down a historic cabin that sat on his Backers Island property. He says it wasn't environmentally friendly.
Burned it for over a period of about 4 days, just a plume of black smoke, and the community really wasn't real happy with that.
There are also hard feelings over a road Davis was building out to the island. Residents worried the work could damage critical habitat. Davis and a friend also blocked part of what the city considers to be a public road after discovering it cut through a corner of one of his properties. The city of Seldovia ordered them to move the barricades, and they refused. Now the city is suing to force them to comply. Here's Campbell again.
Property lines in Seldovia are weird, like a lot of probably small towns in Southeast and stuff. So a lot of folks have gotten together and said, hey, if, you know, no harm, no foul. If you're good, I'm good, and we'll just let it be. You've got your shed on my property, my fence is on your property.
But Campbell says Greg Davis doesn't feel the same way. Davis himself didn't want to be interviewed for this story, but he wrote in an email that his mission is to, as quickly as possible, create the greatest good for the most people. Zane Henning is one of Davis's only supporters in town. He's the friend who helped Davis set up the barricades. He says there's nothing wrong with what they did because it isn't a road. It's private property.
When you own property, you can do with it what you want as long as it's within the regulations of the city code. Property rights and property boundaries have been embedded into our Constitution.
Henning says he and his wife live right in front of the property Davis and the city are fighting over. They don't understand why so much of the town doesn't like Davis.
Because there's been this underlying tone throughout town. It's not underlying, it's clear and above board. I mean, everybody makes statements all the time that they don't like Greg Davis.
Henning says some of that dislike goes back to the amount of property Davis owns.
There was 42 people that didn't want to be here anymore, and Greg bought their properties. It's great for them. He likes real estate. He thinks that this is one of the most beautiful places he's ever been in the world. And so he's buying property. He's got the money to buy the property, and when he gets a good deal on a piece of property, he buys it. I don't see the negative.
Hickman says Davis is basically fighting a battle against the town, and he has no idea how it's going to end.
You know, I think the thing that Greg completely doesn't see, and I wish he could, is that Seldovia is actually a pretty awesome place. Like, we've been doing all right, you know?
Hickman says if Davis felt the same, he might have a better relationship with his neighbors. In Seldovia, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Matsu Valley resident Dennis Ricker. Ricker came to Alaska from Colorado in 1978 and was a wildland firefighter until he retired.
When
went to school in Colorado, came up here looking for a fisheries job, and jumped into the wildland fire game after that. Since about 1978, so a number of years, over 30 years now. Great people, kind of a remote setting, kind of an urban setting. We kind of split our time to come in and see the grandkid in Anchorage, and then we go out to the valley and enjoy you know, the environment out there. Lately, we've jumped into the fat tire bike craze, so we've been doing a lot of that in Willow and Nancy Lake and enjoying the trails here in Anchorage. They're just fantastic. I think the environment is, it's a little harsher than most places, you know, harsher than Arizona, California, but probably not as harsh as some of the adventurous folks that come from Minnesota and, you know, up that way too. So I think it's a community of diverseness, or if that's a word, I guess, diversity, and yet it's people that get along. So, you know, that's what attracts me to this place too. It's a place where people can argue, but still talk. I think only in Alaska could you walk around on the trails and tie in with people that you see involved in the community, you know, involved in issues, involved in the government, you know. Go to a 4th of July parade in Seward and talk to Bill Walker, maybe, you know, before he's elected governor, or being on a trail and, you know, talking to Tony Knowles. Yeah, this is home here, and we have family here. We have a daughter and a son, and I doubt if they'll ever leave. You know, they love it here. So, you know, families grow, I think. So I think we'll stay here, probably travel a little bit more. But, yeah, we'll hang out here.
Dennis Ricker lives in the Matsu Valley. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Quentin Chandler, Wesley Early, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories around the state. I'm Philip Manning.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Emily Russell in Nome, and Emily Schwing and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deedline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.